Thank you. I wish I had thought of the title because it is so very appropriate for the comments that I have to share with you today. First of all, I'd like to assert that with respect to a free society, that there are two inseparable concepts. One is that the due process privileges which we grant to individuals in such a society are inseparable from an independent bar. That is to say that there is no way of enforcing basic notions of constitutional liberties unless there is such a candid, close, and effective relationship, attorney-client privilege relationship between lawyers and their clients, that clients feel free to share their most candid thoughts with counsel. And equally important to the attorney-client privilege is the necessity to recognize and enforce, have a healthy appreciation for, not only the de facto relationship that I'm mentioning, but also, in fact, prevent subtle institutional pressures from arising or institutional arrangements that would thwart or destruct that kind of relationship. And what I'm going to suggest with respect to the Securities and Exchange Commission and the area of securities regulation generally is that institutional pressures have arisen which are destructive of this fundamental concept underlying due process, and that the candid relationship of clients with their lawyers has, to a large extent, become unglued because of very subtle institutional arrangements that have arisen in connection with the Securities Bar and the Securities and Exchange Commission. Those who are damaged by this are businessmen, promoters of securities, and so forth. And those who profit, to a large extent, are the lawyers, who generate high fees for leading their clients through a morass of regulation when there's serious question about whom the lawyers are representing. The trend has been, and I'm going to suggest to you that the pressures are such that the lawyer is placed in the posture that perhaps he is no longer representing the client in traditional terms, but rather has a duty, the government asserts, to a much broader segment of society. And what has happened because of this situation, which I'll spell out a little bit more, is that businessmen are left with fewer of the constitutional safeguards than we would ordinarily associate with a common dope peddler. Part of this is because of an attitude that permeates the government's thinking with respect to securities regulation. I suppose the best way to illustrate that attitude is by a couple of simple quotations from recent addresses by the immediate past chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission and the present director of the Division of Enforcement of the Commission. For example, Ray Garrett, the immediate past chairman of the Commission, referred to those being regulated, those under the jurisdiction of the Securities and Exchange Commission, refers to them as robber barons, princes of privilege, and malefactors of great wealth, and posturing them in such a position is indicative of his feeling that such persons obviously don't need the constitutional safeguards that we would ordinarily associate with a rapist. And the director of the Division of Enforcement for the Securities and Exchange Commission, when excusing The absence of safeguards, due process safeguards in this area says, well, after all, these people are the fat cats, aren't they? These are direct quotations from recent expressions of the regulators in this particular area. Perhaps securities regulation really isn't any different from other areas of the law. Maybe these expressions that tell us something about the feelings of the regulators, their predispositions and so forth, is perhaps part of the great leveling process that we seem to go on, and part of what the government views as notions of egalitarianism. But it's far more significant than that, because in fact, not only does it put the so-called robber barons in a position where they're less favored than more common criminals, but it also does something to thwart the very purposes of the securities laws, which is announced to be full disclosure. I'll discuss that in a few moments. How does this happen? How does the securities lawyer, in a sense, abdicate his professional responsibility to his client and become a representative of the government or an arm of the enforcement activities of the Securities and Exchange Commission? All of it begins, really, with the Securities and Exchange Commission announcing its motivation in the purest of all forms. It says, for example, that it has an awfully big job to do. It must regulate a nationwide securities market with an undercapitalized and very small force. And because there are so few enforcers, so few regulators to do what the SEC views as an enormous job, the commission says that it must rely to a large part for its enforcement activities on the securities bar. Therefore, putting the securities bar in the position of enforcers as well as representatives of industry. A recent expression by a member of the Securities and Exchange Commission was to the effect that the securities lawyer is another cop on the beat. This is justified, says the government, on the grounds that there is more and greater fraud today than there ever was before. Failing, of course, to recognize all of the evidence in this area, starting with the efficient market hypothesis and going to recent work by people like George Benston, comparing the amount of fraud after empirical work, comparing the amount of fraud subsequent to the enactment of the Securities Act of 1933 and the Securities Exchange Act of 1934 with the amount prior, making appropriate adjustments and so forth, and finding that there is no more now than there was before enactment of the securities laws. Nonetheless, the Securities and Exchange Commission asserts that there's more fraud today than there was, than there has ever been, and that the fraud is of a much more severe magnitude, and therefore justifying placing the lawyer in the posture of being another cop on the beat. A second device that the government uses is announced in the name of self-regulation. Self-regulation is better than government regulation, we're told, because the government doesn't directly intervene, but rather the industry establishes standards for itself and regulates and administers those standards. But of course, those standards are approved under the provisions of the Securities Exchange Act of 1934 by the SEC. The SEC disapproves of them. It may simply order that industry that is self-regulating to alter its standards, which the government does all the time. Not so much by explicit pronouncement, but by more subtle devices. Well, one of the ways in which self-enforcement is achieved is by placing in-house spies in securities firms and underwriting operations. Part of the self-governing aspect of the securities industry is that management in a securities firm will overlook the salesman's activities to do make sure that those activities don't go farther than they should, and to make sure that misstatements and material omissions aren't being made to clients of the firm. Part of this device that's used is eavesdropping on telephone calls, tape recording, some of them intercepting mail, and so forth. Notions like this would obviously never be condoned in other areas of the law, basic criminal areas, certainly not without a warrant issued by an appropriate court having jurisdiction, yet in the securities area they're utilized all the time, and never with the warrant safeguards that we associate with other areas. The investigative functions of the Securities and Exchange Commission really are another device. Did that microphone go off? Another device for accomplishing this same thing. And the nature of those proceedings warrants mentioning because of the peculiar position that lawyers and clients are placed in by virtue of them. And I'll go through the investigative and enforcement function of the commission with you as an illustration of this. For example, the Securities and Exchange Commission has subpoena power if it believes not only that a crime has been committed with respect to the securities laws, but that a crime may be committed. And it has the power to issue these subpoenas not just with respect to persons who may be deemed to be engaged in the commission or about to commit a securities crime, but also anybody else who has information regarding matters like this. So a subpoena ducis tecum is issued ordering a witness to come before the agency and bring all his books and records and so forth. The witness who is subpoenaed may not know, however, whether he's a target of the investigation. In other words, whether he is under investigation. Furthermore, he's not told in the subpoena or otherwise beforehand the nature of the investigation, the title of the investigation, which firm or individual is being investigated, and the role of this person being subpoenaed in the investigation. In other words, it's an open-ended investigation. And interestingly enough, and this ought to sound awfully peculiar to you, it certainly shocks me each time I see it happen, a person subpoenaed never sees an order of the investigation until he actually appears at the hearing or at the place where his testimony is taken. It is only at that point that he sees an order. And at that point, he's not permitted to have a copy of the order. In fact, he's never permitted to have a copy of the order. He's permitted only to look at, view the order. Now, the order doesn't tell him very much in any event. All it says is, in the matter of the Securities and Exchange Commission and such, the name of the firm, et al. And the et al. May include that witness, or it may not, but we don't know because the et al.'s aren't listed. That this matter has been deemed an appropriate investigation, the order goes on to say, because the commission has reason to believe that there has been or may be a violation of the anti-fraud provisions of the securities laws in connection with a particular rule, or simply several general rules. Usually only very general rules are stated and no specifics or charges are stated in the order. So the person sits down, the witness sits down, and the questioning begins, if he permits himself to be asked the questions and then answers them, with respect to a matter over which he has almost no, with regard to which he has almost no information at all. Now, at this point, the witness has really only two possibilities. One possibility is to say, well, I don't know what's going on. And the one way of finding out is by answering the questions, because maybe the questions will tell me about something that's going on. And I don't think I've done anything wrong, so I have nothing to hide, so I'll go ahead and answer the questions. Another possibility, however, is for the witness to invoke his Fifth Amendment constitutional privileges against self-incrimination. Now, it's important to note the administrative view of invoking Fifth Amendment privileges before the Securities and Exchange Commission. The SEC obviously doesn't think very much of it. As a matter of fact, I've heard it said at private investigations by the commission from staff attorneys for the commission to witnesses and their counsel that invoking the Fifth Amendment privileges is a sure way to precipitate an indictment. In other words, cooperation will be helpful. Failure to cooperate is used often as a kind of sword of Damocles over the head of the witness to ensure or solicit his cooperation. Those who are cooperate with the government are dealt with lightly. Those who invoke Fifth Amendment privileges are not. The irony of this is that at the same time, the SEC is strangely solicitous to ensure that the respondents in such a proceeding have separate counsel. As a matter of fact, they go so far with this notion of separate counsel that they'll often sequester lawyers and witnesses, not permitting a lawyer in a securities investigation to represent more than one witness in the investigation. Why? Well, it's justified in terms of a conflict of interest. In other words, if the lawyer represents more than one witness, and if the witnesses have opposing positions in the investigation, the lawyer may have a conflict of interest with respect to that representation. I'm going to suggest to you, perhaps, that it may be viewed in another way, and that it may be viewed as a device used to divide and conquer. In other words, if we bring the witnesses in separately, and we do it in a kind of a cloak and dagger way, so they don't know who the witnesses are, and that they each have separate counsel, and that counsel and witnesses are sequestered, and that no orders of the investigation are issued, and that the witnesses and the respondents are not named with specificity, then what happens is it is more likely that the witnesses in such a proceeding will begin pointing the fingers at each other. And indeed, that's what tends to happen. They blame each other when other persons are not present, and the lawyers are not in a position to determine who is really responsible for what because of the sequestration rule. The sequestration rule is enforced very strongly. I should also mention that part of the leverage that the agency uses is to advise clients, witnesses rather, in connection with an SEC investigation, that the government takes a very dim view of a witness discussing his testimony with other parties to the matter. Now, such behavior in connection with breaking and entering case or a murder case would not only be not condoned by the court, but would result in severe disciplinary action against the district attorney or the government for suggesting that it's improper for a witness to discuss his testimony with the defense. Indeed, that goes to the very nature of the preparation of a case on behalf of persons accused of crimes. So we begin with a situation where a witness does not know whether he's being charged with a violation of the securities laws, and this extends all the way to a conclusion of the investigation, which may go on for years. And even when the matter is ended, and the Securities and Exchange Commission finds no evidence to warrant disciplinary action against anyone, an announcement is never made that the investigation is ended. And the witnesses and possible targets of the investigation may go on for years with the subtle emotional and psychological pressures of not knowing whether an investigation has been culminated. This whole process has been studied carefully by a committee, a select committee of the Securities Bar, which issued a report. Among the recommendations in that report was that counsel for witnesses in a Securities and Exchange Commission investigation who are possible targets of the investigation, not named necessarily as targets, but who are possible targets, should have the opportunity to submit to the Securities and Exchange Commission a position paper or a recommendation with regard to their client's participation in the investigated matter and recommendations with regard to that client, whether it be simply to assert that the client did no wrong or to assert mitigating circumstances or whatever. Interesting thing is that that recommendation was never adopted, and there is no right for counsel to go before the Securities and Exchange Commission either in the course of the investigation or after the investigation has been concluded to make a presentation on behalf of the client. This is particularly ironic when we note that the Securities and Exchange Commission is the investigative body, the prosecutorial body, and the adjudicative body with respect to many securities matters. It initiates the investigation, it does the investigation. The investigation is then turned over to the Securities and Exchange Commission members who make the determination of whether there should be discipline, and then the commission acts in an adjudicative position. Of course, there is appeal to the courts at that point, but at that point, the time, the transactions costs in such matters are tremendously high, and the bad publicity that's already been generated works as a kind of life and death matter with regard to the people being investigated. Well, how does the Securities and Exchange Commission enlist the cooperation of lawyers to create the kind of atmosphere that I'm suggesting to you? Well, there is a system of rewards and punishments that probably isn't peculiar to securities regulation, although I know more about it in this connection with this area, and perhaps I'm better able to give you some illustrations of how it works here. One way is to advance certain special privileges for lawyers who cooperate in this manner and use very subtle punishments for those who do not. Well, what are the privileges and what are the punishments? Those lawyers who cooperate to create this kind of atmosphere and not challenge the government's position, and not only substantively, but procedurally, are that the lawyers have access to the Securities and Exchange Commission that might not otherwise be accorded. For example, the regulatory process in connection with securities is a long and complex one. And often the government will give positions, will undertake positions at the outset of a matter, establishing that it will not take action against a person if they proceed in a particular way. Those are so-called no action letters. Now, those are very, very valuable because in a gray area of the law, it helps determine what is lawful in an informal kind of way and what is not. Right? Those lawyers who are cooperative have access to the government, to the agency, with respect to no action requests, and those who are not simply do not have that kind of access. Furthermore, those who are cooperative are invited to participate on nationwide panels and advertise their specialties and their special skills, especially in an atmosphere when advertising as such wasn't permitted earlier. Of course, that's changing rapidly, but it was more significant in earlier times when that was one of the more popular and lawful ways for lawyers to advertise. Well, the punishments are that disciplinary action may be taken against the lawyer in this kind of star chamber manner that I've discussed, and I'll mention some of those devices in a moment. Well, what kind of a position is the lawyer placed in, and to whom does he have a duty? The kind of duty that we see evolving in the securities laws probably can be best analogized to that which you already recognize in connection with the position of independent accountants to their client businesses. That independent accountants, assertion is, have a duty not just to their clients, or primarily to their clients, but have a duty to the public to ensure full disclosure according to generally accepted accounting principles. And the notion in securities regulation is that lawyers have a responsibility not so much to their clients any longer, although they indeed have some responsibility, even the government admits there, but mainly a responsibility to the public. That's part of the self-enforcing aspect of this kind of regulation. The National Student Marketing case, which is now pending in the United States District Court for the Southern District of New York, is illustrative of this. In that case, the Securities and Exchange Commission brought an injunctive proceeding against two well-known law firms, one White & Case, which is one of the important establishment law firms of New York, and Lord Bissell & Abbott, a comparable Chicago law firm. The government claims in that case that those two law firms were aware that their client was about to commit a violation of the federal securities laws, and that the client failed to comply with the asserted notion of their professional responsibility. The government says that the professional responsibility of a lawyer in this area is first to advise the client that he is about to do wrong, and secondly, to attempt to convince the lawyer to change his attitude and do right. Failure of the client to do right triggers a responsibility, the case goes on to say, the complaint goes on to say, on behalf of the lawyer to come forward to the government and advise the government that the client is about to violate the securities, the federal securities laws. In other words, blow the whistle. Now, this is a notion that is very, very peculiar, and perhaps may be justified in with respect to crimes such as murder, although I'm not sure that there is even a professional standard that goes quite as far in that area, but is most peculiar in the area of securities regulation. What it really does is put the lawyer in the position where if this is the standard, who can get to the confessional booth first, confess his sins, and receive the blessing of the chief of enforcement of the commission for behaving in that way and thereby triggering enforcement activities against the person on whom the whistle is blown. Well, what's happened very subtly, even without the court having adopted yet this standard on behalf of lawyers, is that the securities bar is behaving as if this is the appropriate standard of professional responsibility. And the rush has been on to the confessional booth in Washington to blow the whistle on clients. And that matter has been tested in one important recent case where the lawyer did just that, and the court in the Southern District of New York held it not under the circumstances in that case to be a violation of the attorney-client privilege or other notions of professional responsibility. Now, that was a fairly narrow case. A general assertion that this is the appropriate standard of care can't be made at this point, and perhaps the National Student Marketing case will not result in the rule that the Securities and Exchange Commission is advocating, Nonetheless, we at the moment have a standard of care or behavior by lawyers that has virtually adopted the government's standard of professional responsibility. What happens with regard to this then? I think what happens and what I've observed is clients being less candid with their lawyers. Because if they know that the lawyer is going to run to the government, there's certainly less incentive to tell the lawyer about matters that may be questionable, and certainly matters that are obviously violative of the securities laws. To the extent the clients are less candid, it's obvious that less disclosure will be made. And if less disclosure is made, it's obvious that this standard of professional responsibility is fundamentally at odds and contrary to the very nature of the securities laws, which is to generate more and better disclosure, whatever that is. Now, failure of the lawyer to behave in this manner may result in disciplinary action. How? Well, it's not uncommon for lawyers who fail to cooperate at an investigation of their client to be, at that investigation, served with a subpoena themselves. In other words, placing the lawyer in the position that they are a witness. To the extent that they are at that point made witnesses or respondents to the investigation themselves, they must drop representation of that particular client. Now, maybe the next lawyer coming in will be more cooperative. And in order for the lawyer to move forward and establish the wrongdoing on the part of the government, he has to go through the whole administrative process where this act is carried out to some kind of administrative conclusion. And at that point, has the right to appeal. Well, at that point, it's too late, because the barn is burned down. And in any event, the cost to the lawyer in terms of adverse publicity when the appeal hits the press is tremendous. And one of the devices that the government, the Securities and Exchange Commission, uses subtly enforce this kind of standard of care on behalf of lawyers is the dissemination of very subtly contrived adverse publicity. For example, when interviewed by the Wall Street Journal or Business Week or some other business organ, the director of the Division of Enforcement or a staff attorney at the commission will say something to the effect that this is the biggest ripoff he's seen since he has been a staff lawyer with the Securities and Exchange Commission, and so forth. Well, if we were talking about a narcotics case or a rape case, such behavior on the part of the prosecutor would be subject to severe reprimand and disciplinary action by the courts. Doesn't seem to result in that in anything like that in the area of securities regulation. There are two justifications for changing the role of the lawyer in the securities area from the role that he plays in the attorney-client relationship in other areas. These justifications are asserted by the Securities and Exchange Commission in, number one, that the securities laws are civil in nature and not primarily criminal. Well, that's so patently absurd that I'm not sure it's worthy of much discussion now. Because they're primarily civil, the government goes on, the lawyer is not in the traditional advocative position, adversary position. Well, in truth, the civil device for prophylactic relief sought by the government, injunctive relief sought by the government, is often used as a prelude for a later criminal reference. And we usually find the chain of events occurring as first an investigation, secondly an injunction suit being initiated, thirdly a consent decree being agreed upon, and lastly criminal reference being made to the Justice Department. Secondly, this kind of role change for lawyers is justified in that the SEC lawyer is an office lawyer primarily and not a litigator. Because he's not a litigator, he's less of an adversary. Because he's an office lawyer, he doesn't have this traditional adversary role where if two lawyers in an adversary condition, atmosphere, are arguing their separate causes, somehow the jury in the court will find the truth somewhere in the middle. Therefore, the lawyer in the office has a different standard of care. Well, what often happens is that the office lawyer, while indeed representing the client in the office, is in a very severely adversary position because of all the antagonistic relationships that give rise in connection with the marketing of securities. So I think that these two justifications are erroneous. Now, what's happened is that there are really two standards of professional responsibility with respect to lawyers. One is the professional responsibility, that form of professional responsibility that we associate with other crimes, and secondly, the kind of professional responsibility that we associate with administrative areas like securities regulation. Because many of the lawyers in the securities regulation area were prior staff members of the Securities and Exchange Commission, they have special relationships with the commission. And those relationships are ongoing relationships. They don't want to see those relationships altered because those relationships give them access to very important information and privileges regarding representation of their clients. Furthermore, the more the regulation is, the greater the fees are that are generated for lawyers, and that's fundamental with regard to any area, I guess, of government regulation. And William Casey, the former chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission, announced to a very large audience of over 1,000 persons connection with a securities regulation panel recently that don't complain about our enforcement activities, they're making you rich. It's no longer becoming a subtle manner of behaving with respect to the government, but is presented in a very crude, crass way. What I'm suggesting to you is, and it is clear to me, that if we're not to corrupt the attorney-client relationship, we can't gravely threaten the independence of the bar. And the independence of the bar is fundamental to the maintenance of a free society. We don't seem to see that happening in the area of securities regulation. There is some hope, however, that it may happen. I think the reason that things may change somewhat is because the government is so overburdened with the consent decree syndrome. It simply can't try the cases it is initiating. It initiates thousands of cases, hoping to settle virtually all of them. It doesn't have the manpower, either in terms of training or simply in terms of bodies, to try these lawsuits that are being filed. As a result, the government is relying primarily upon consent decrees. Well, as it does that, and as it's less prepared for trial and less able to win convictions, hopefully it'll push lawyers to a different margin where they'll be willing to try more cases with a view of obtaining a total exoneration than they would otherwise.
Thank you, Professor Mofsky. I guess our mic has gone dead on us. Can you all hear back there? Rather than comment directly on Professor Mofsky's paper and one of the unique roles of chairman during this session today is that we also have the duty of discussing or at least giving a mini paper of ourselves in the general topic area. I'm not a lawyer, and hence I really don't feel well qualified to comment directly on Professor Mofsky's paper. But however, my special area of research and teaching is in the area of finance, especially financial markets. Much of my recent research has been devoted to an analysis of insider trading of over-the-counter securities. The special emphasis of my research and others doing similar research is an examination of the efficient markets hypothesis, or how efficient really are capital markets. And Professor Mofsky's paper does touch on this, and really this lies at the heart of his arguments against the SEC in that he feels that much of their enforcement and in their practice, they work against disclosure, against efficient dissemination of information. Now, there have been a number of studies in recent years of securities markets, and they have found that the American capital market is extraordinarily efficient. And Professor Mofsky and I were talking earlier that it's really a curiosity that one of the most vehement enforcement agencies in the federal bureaucracy is dealing in an area in which we have an amazingly efficient capital market. This market is efficient in a sense that information about companies, which has an impact upon their financial well-being, is discounted at an extremely rapid rate and very efficiently in the capital market. In fact, some studies have shown that stock prices often react before important financial information is released. For instance, if there's going to be an increase in the dividend rate, it is observed that stock prices generally rise before, sometimes as much as 6 months before, the actual occurrence. The interesting thing is, when the market has guessed wrong and the dividend rate is not increased or is not increased to the extent that was expected and discounted by the market, then the price drops back down to the previous level. Studies concentrating upon insider trading, and insiders are simply defined as directors or owners of 10% or more of the common stock of publicly traded corporations and close associates. These studies of insider trading have determined, at least for listed securities, that the level of profits generated for insiders has been minimal at best, especially once you adjust for transaction costs and taxes. One would expect in an efficient capital market that only the information that still lies with inside the corporation, held by the corporate insiders, this is the only information that we would expect not to be fully discounted in an efficient capital market. Hence, it would not surprise me to find long-term existence of profits to insiders, especially given the blocks to efficient flow of information provided through SEC regulation of insider information. In an excellent book published by Henry Maney, I think in 56, entitled The Economics of Insider Trading, which really does not get a thorough enough reading in the profession, certainly not in my profession, and I think broadly, Henry Maney advocates a free market in insider information. This would allow insiders to immediately profit, if they so choose, from their inside information, selling it to the highest bidder, in essence. Their immediate gains would tend to be minimized in an effective market system, whereas the gains in market efficiency in getting information about the corporation out to investors for them to evaluate would be far more beneficial than the minimal profits that would accrue to the insiders. In the name of increased market efficiency, the SEC now restricts the flow of insider information by prohibiting the sale or profit from inside information possessed by insiders, now so broadly defined by the SEC as to include anyone. The only principal way, then, of outsiders, average investors, of discovering material facts about impending problems within a firm is through illegal leaks of information, for which the insiders and outsiders using the information can be severely punished by the SEC. A case in point, Raymond L. Dirks, a former broker, is now in the process of litigation by the SEC for warning his customers that something was awry in equity funding back in 1968 and 69. His book, entitled The Great Wall Street Scandal, co-authored with Mr. Gross, published by McGraw-Hill of 1974, details many of the gory details and facts of this case. In fact, the auditors of equity funding were alleged to have attested to the existence of assets that never existed. The earnings reports for over 10 years were almost totally fabricated by top management. Instead of receiving a medal from the SEC for whistleblowing, but here he blew the whistle to the public and not the SEC first. Professor Mofsky pointed out earlier that was his major error. Had he ratted to the SEC first and got under their so-called umbrella, he probably would not have spent, he has maintained, over $100,000 trying to defend himself against attack from the SEC. The only legal means for outsiders of discovering material facts of what's happening inside the corporation is through a rather crude information system of watching insider trading in their own securities. And this has been my area of research. I have examined insider trading on over-the-counter stocks. These would be the best candidate for a very poor information flow. There are many, many over-the-counter companies, over 14,000, mostly small, tightly held, few outstanding shares in most cases, and for the most part, a very small insider team. So if there was any information problem of information getting out from a corporation, one would expect to see it in very clearly with over-the-counter securities. Well, the results of our study of over 93 over-the-counter stocks for a period 1966 through 74 showed not only that insiders do tend to profit from their trading in their own stocks, but so could an interested outsider applying some very simple filtering rules. For instance, we applied a rule of a net two or more insiders buying and or selling a stock was taken as a buy or sell sign to an outsider. However, there was a definite deterioration of insider profits, as well as the profits to outsiders reacting to insider information, over the period 66 to 74, indicating a general decline either in market in the general market price for these over-the-counter securities, which we did find evidence for, but there were actually two bull markets and two bear markets that we identified during this period. Another explanation for this deterioration of insider profits over the period was that the market was simply becoming more efficient at reading and discounting insider information in over-the-counter stocks. I believe it was a combination of the two factors, and I don't think we can discount the fact that markets probably are becoming more efficient, even in this probably least efficient area of information dissemination, that is over-the-counter stocks. I was, and I remain, rather apprehensive about releasing the data on this paper for fear that people inside the SEC will begin a vendetta against insiders of over-the-counter stocks. Let me briefly quote from my paper. The results of this study indicate that insiders in general do not take losses, even short-term losses, in the stocks of their own company, nor would we expect them to. They often sell. By selling and buying back after the stock price has recovered, insiders are able to gain profits on both the up and down price trends of their firm's stock. The statistical results of this analysis clearly indicate the practice of profitable selling by insiders in a downward market and profitable buying in an upward market. Although no attempt is made in my study to determine if the same individual insiders are doing the buying and selling of a particular stock. It is the author's opinion, I go on to quote, that it would be most unfortunate if the FCC, SEC were to take steps to eliminate what appears to be widespread violation, if not the letter, certainly the spirit of insider prohibition against profitable trading of the company's stock. First of all, it is the existence of these SEC rules and prohibitions against insider profit taking that have been partly responsible for the substantial information gap regarding insider knowledge. The observed profits to insider trading in OTC stocks exist precisely because this information gap exists. Therefore, any corrective steps, I'm using corrective in quotation marks, taken by the SEC to eliminate insider profits may have the effect of increasing the market inefficiency that insider trading rules have helped to create. A second factor which has tended to generate large profits to insider trading in OTC stocks is the lack of sufficient information regarding the reasons for insider trading activity. All we have from the SEC Monthly Report of Insider Activity is the names of the insiders and the numbers of shares they're buying and or selling. No reasons, of course, are given. In fact, if they were to give a reason, it would probably be self-incriminating from an SEC point of view. It is necessary, I recommend, for the SEC to relax the prohibitions on insider profits in order to allow for a freer flow of information from insiders to outsiders in the market so that a greater efficient market is possible. Thank you. Now we've got plenty of time for questions. Yes.
This point about due process of law is really one that carries it over into a lot of other areas too, as I think you acknowledge. And I think OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Act, is a good example of it, where they can come in and make inspections without warrants and that type of thing. I was just wondering, kind of a double question on this, is this is the most propitious time probably to make a constitutional challenge on this whole area with the five Nixon Court appointees to the Supreme Court. Is there any indication that there would be a cohesive point of view by those five appointees if this were able to be brought up before them as an overall issue? And then the second part of the question is there any litigation going up to the U.S. Supreme Court calculated to present this entire constitutional issue to the court at this time? With Carter having won the election, it may be many years before we ever get back to an equally good time to raise this type of constitutional.
Did everyone hear that question? Okay, the question essentially is this a good opportunity, perhaps during the hiatus before the Carter administration, and given the Nixon appointees to the Supreme Court, of testing some of the misuse of law and due process by some of the administrative agencies, especially OSHA and certainly the SEC? And I'd like Professor Mofsky to comment on it.
Well, with respect to securities regulation, it may be, we may be forced into doing it at this time, regardless of whether it's a propitious time for it, the challenge to be made. The national student marketing case certainly presents the appropriate case for Supreme Court review. And the government apparently has taken the position that it's not going to back off in that case, and White and Case and Lord Bissell and Abbott can't afford to. There's some reason to believe that case could go all the way. I think that there is some reason also to think that with respect to the attorney-client privilege, at least in the way that I've been discussing it today, that the court will not adopt the presently constituted court would not adopt the government's standard of professional responsibility. There is a concerted effort by a number of non-securities bar groups to present amicus briefs. They already have presented their points of view at the trial level with regard to the appropriate standard of care. And the cooperation of the American Civil Liberties Union is obviously one that has already been obtained.
Professor Tulloch.
Of course, excuse me. Did everyone hear that question? Let me try to restate it, Gordon. Professor Tulloch has raised the issue of the substantial entry costs in the capital market of a new securities flotation, or in fact, even a secondary offering of securities flotation, as being a substantial barrier to efficient capital markets. And I'd like Professor Mofsky to comment on that.
Well, I certainly wouldn't disagree with what you said. I've only concentrated on one aspect of the regulatory process, the title of the session being Let's Kill All the Lawyers. But with regard to your point, let me suggest some statistics that illustrate the importance of it. The costs of public offerings, I've recently done a study of the costs of public offerings, and there's an inverse relationship between the size of the offering and the percentage of costs. In other words, as the size of the offering gets smaller, the cost as a percentage gets higher. The percentage cost for a public offering of between $500,000 and $1 million is something in the neighborhood of in excess of 20%. Of the amount being sought to be raised. And as the offering, size of the public offering goes down under $500,000, the percentage is well over 20%. It's interesting to note, not only in terms of relative or absolute terms, how high those costs are, but the state securities laws, the so-called blue sky laws, prohibit expenses for public offerings in excess of certain percentages. And it's noteworthy that the maximum permissible expenses under most of the state laws is less than the real costs that now prevail. So those are entry barriers not just created by SEC regulation, but by state securities regulation and the merit rules. I would agree with what you said.
Carl, I'm puzzled by a moral problem. Fraud is inherently repulsive, and we all are against fraud. And that, unfortunately, forces us into a situation that if we advocate deregulation, we are our opponents, the regulators, can say, aha, that proves that you un-Americans are in favor of fraud.
As before, there's certainly an awful lot of evidence of that, and arguing for deregulation doesn't accordingly argue for fraud. That's not very, that obviously isn't very helpful.
I think that was a freestanding statement, and that's certainly accepted here. You don't have to address questions. I think that's very useful, and we still have 10 minutes, and I'd like to have Dave Williams, because he had his hand up earlier. Hear that? I wouldn't dare try to restate that question. Professor Mofsky.
Yeah, the last year's president of the ACLU and current national board members of the ACLU are very much aware of what's happening in the white-collar crime area and have taken positions openly with regard to it, and I believe the ACLU is in the process of preparing a brief in the national student marketing case. So they are active in the area.
Yes, Paul had his hand up earlier.
This is a simple question, but it's one that interests me. Would you
corporate public relationship versus the broker client relationship representing the issue. In other words, statements made by the broker to the client, and how what attitude does the SEC take against that versus the information furnished by the corporation to the public. Getting back to this comment here, every prospectus, of course, has on there in wording to the effect that only the information in the prospectus is to be accepted, and anything said outside that is normal. Is there a difference in their attitude there?
Okay, did everyone get that question? I think he's asking for a statement on the dichotomy between a broker-client release of information about the corporation and the official release of information by the corporation through the prospectus.
There's no difference in attitude, but there is a difference in enforcement, because it's obviously much more difficult to police the telephone conversation than it is to police the dissemination of written documents. The interesting enforcement technique that's used in the brokerage industry is eavesdropping on telephone conversations between brokers and their clients, which is a practice that's done regularly. I don't know whether you're familiar with it, but it's done by so-called in-house spies, who may be lawyers, former staff members of the Securities and Exchange Commission who go into industry afterwards, trained for listening to the kinds of things that could be inappropriate or violative of the broker-customer relationship. That's one way. Opening mail and looking at it is another way. If a violation is found, the recourse by the broker or the salesman is just not very helpful, because the disciplinary proceeding takes place before the commission. The commission is the prosecutor in the matter. The investigation is discovered by the Securities and Exchange Commission, and only that, after all of that, can appeal be taken to the courts. And the bad publicity, after all of that, plus the costs involved, result in few appeals.
Yes, Dr. Kirshner had his hand up earlier.
I understood Professor Mostek to say that the cost of raising money in the public security markets was about 20%. I wonder if he could break that down into the cost of raising different monies for different kinds of securities. Debenture bonds, for instance, secured bonds, preferred stocks of various kinds, and common stocks. It's surely not 20% for all of them, isn't it? Isn't there a differential there that would be interesting and useful for us to know?
The question is asking if Professor Mofsky, in his research, has uncovered specific data on the flotation costs for various financial instruments, including common stocks, bonds, and other instruments.
Yes, I can't answer the question, and you are right. There are differences depending upon the kind of how we characterize the security and the size of the offering. First of all, the larger the offering, the smaller the costs are as a percentage of it. In other words, there's an inverse relationship between the two. With regard to very small offerings, I indicated that the cost as a percentage was in excess of 20%. As the size of the offering increases, the costs diminish. Also, the costs of equity financing tend to be higher as a percentage than the costs of debt financing. Furthermore, if there's a combination of security and debt financing, in other words, a mortgage bond, not an unsecured debenture, the costs of financing tend to be lower. It's a function of the risks of underwriting a particular issue. The costs in connection with a public offering by, let's say, American Telephone and Telegraph Company of a multi-million dollar debenture offering are well below 5%, somewhere in the neighborhood of 2 to 3%.
But the average, you say, is 20%?
No. What I said was that the costs of financing for a securities equity offering of between $500,000 and $1 million averaged 20%, in excess of 20%. Pardon?
That was just for equity.
Just for equity, right. It's high enough.
By the way, to augment this study, there have been recent studies comparing flotation costs, SEC regulation costs, that is SEC registration costs in the United States with, say, Western Europe, flotation in Western Europe. The costs are substantially lower there, which indicates that we are carrying a very heavy burden in the SEC regulations statements. And I'm not sure that the information here is any better than what is available in, say, the euro-dollar, euro-bond market. And let's have a question, this gentleman back here. Professor Vandenhaag has raised the issue of the constitutionality of and legality or human rights, the morality. Okay. The morality of the Fifth Amendment. Professor Mofsky, you want to tackle that one?
No.
Yes. Yes, the question is, to what extent does SEC regulation encourage large corporations to the expense of smaller corporations as an anti-competitive device?
Yeah, there's a lot of evidence on that point, and the answer is that it's a severe anti-competitive device. Let me give you an illustration of it with a particular example, and that's the merit regulations underlying state securities regulation. They require, for example, that before an offering can come to market, it must meet certain standards of fairness, justness, and being equitable. Those standards of fairness are quantified by securities regulators through rules that make it more costly, difficult, and often impossible for smaller, more speculative issues to come to market than would be the case in the absence of the regulation. For example, one rule is that with respect to newly promoted firms or smaller firms, the promoters of the firms must invest a certain amount of their own capital relative to the amount sought to be raised publicly. In some states it's 15%, other states it's 20%, and so forth. For an asset-less promoter, it's impossible to raise capital publicly under the securities laws, and the obvious anti-competitive effect, you know, of that comes to bear. With respect to the, I recognize, Professor Vandenhaag, your point with regard to the Fifth Amendment. Was not so much interested in addressing myself to the desirability of the Fifth Amendment privilege so much as to put it in the context of the enforcement scheme of things and to note how it was used in enforcement. Yeah. Well, would you deny the ability of a witness before the SEC or a court simply to remain totally silent?
Our appointed time has ended. Let's have one quick question.
Sort of more general follow-up on what Professor Vondentag said, which is, I recognize that to the extent that your talk was something of an attack on liberal hypocrisy about business versus crime cases, I think it's valid across the board, but to the extent that you were implying that prosecutors and their functions operate differently between the two areas, I wonder if that's really valid, that a prosecutor in deciding how to go after somebody in a criminal case is going to use the Fifth Amendment. If you say you're going to take the Fifth Amendment, or if as a witness you take the Fifth Amendment, a prosecutor in a criminal case will certainly become more suspicious and go out and try to get you in different ways. And I recognize there's some differences in the administrative process, but I wonder if a good deal of what you said simply did not apply to the way the prosecutors operate in the legal system as a whole, and not in some way special to the SEC.
For example,
a radical lawyer talking about the use of grand juries who said a vast number of the same things.
Indeed. I recognize probably that that there isn't really much difference between securities regulation and other areas of non-white-collar crime areas and the behavior of prosecutors. But it is important to note that the standards that are announced are different, and that occasionally we do see some disciplinary action taken against prosecutors in other areas who overstep traditional safeguards, but not in the securities area at all.
My watch shows about 25 to 11. The next session reconvenes at 11, and I notice we have coffee in the back. Thank you.